Thank you, Brother Paul. This is the 2013 Winter Study Weekend. Brother Jim Cowie is our speaker. The overall theme is Gibeah of Saul. This is study number 4, Thou Shalt Perform Unto the Lord Thine Oaths. And our reading was 2 Samuel 21, the first 14 verses. Brother Jim.
Well, thank you, Brother Tim, and good morning, brethren and sisters and young people. We come now to finish off our consideration of Gibeah of Saul. And we learnt yesterday just how important covenants and oaths and vows are to our God and how important they ought to be to us. And we saw something of the life of Saul, at least the preparation of Saul for the work as first king of Israel. And we know, of course, that he was an utter failure in that. I want to start this morning with a quotation from Brother Roberts from The Visible Hand of God. He wrote this about Saul's unfaithfulness. Saul proved an unfaithful king. What that means will be discerned by those who understand the difference between faithfulness in its common acceptation and faithfulness towards God. A man is faithful in the common acceptation who performs what he undertakes as between man and man. But a man faithful to God is one who aims at carrying out the appointments of God for no other reason than that they are the appointments of God. Such a man has such a name because he discerns and is deeply impressed with the fact that all things belong to God, and that God only has the right to appoint what is to be done. A typically very sound and wise comment from Brother Roberts, is it not? But it sets the course for what we have to say here this morning, because we're going to see that Saul completely failed in every aspect of his relationship with God. And he was only successful in one relationship with men, and that was the one with the witch of Endor. So it tells you something about this man as Israel's first king. There's no question about vows having to be kept in the Word of God, is there? I want to show you a series of passages. Deuteronomy 23, verse 23, and for the sake of time, I'm not going to turn these up. Just read them off the screen. But up to you, you can look them up if you wish. That which is gone out of thy lips, thou shalt keep and perform, even a freewill offering, according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 4, adds these words. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Saul was a fool. Pay that which thou hast vowed. And we go on, of course, and we have a look at Christ's attitude to vows and promises and covenants. In the Messianic Psalm, Psalm 61 and verse 8, we read, so will I sing praise unto thy name forever, that I may daily perform my vows. So his whole life surrounded the keeping of his covenant with his God. And of course, that was going to lead to the confirmation of God's covenant with the fathers of Israel. So that's why it was so critical for him to keep this principle in the forefront of his mind. You know, he quotes Leviticus 19, verse 12, in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 33. Leviticus 19, 12 says, and ye shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am Yahweh. So the Lord picks that up in his discourse on the mount. In Matthew 5, and he says, again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shall perform unto the Lord thine oaths. So this morning, what I want to do is to go through very quickly the oaths and the vows that Saul made and broke. We'll have a look at them. Has to be quick because there were many of them, and he broke them all, except for that one with the witch of Endor. Let's start, shall we, in 1 Samuel chapter 14. 1 Samuel 14 is that story of the incredible faith of Jonathan and his armour bearer. There was a garrison of the Philistines, remember, not far from where Saul had been established as king. And in 1 Samuel 14, Jonathan decides that the time has come to deal with these Philistines. His father was supposed to be doing that, you remember. So Jonathan takes up the battle against the Philistines. He shows amazing faith because, you see, he says to his armour bearer, look, if we say to the Philistines, you come down to us, and they do that, well, that's fine. But if they say, you come up to us, which is the most likely thing, of course, isn't it? They're not going to say, well, look, we'll clamber down the cliff and expose ourselves to danger. You do that. You climb the cliff and expose yourself to danger. Well, of course, it was obvious what was going to happen. So Jonathan and his armour bearer climbed the cliff, and they defeated the Philistines that day, and there was a massive slaughter of the Philistines. But it all came unstuck. And so we pick the record up in verse 24. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying... Now, what's this adjured? Well, actually, it's an oath of adjuration. So he makes an oath of adjuration. He involves the name of God. And that oath was about preventing anyone eating that day until sunset. So the men of Israel were distressed because, you know, they were fighting a battle. Now, you know, we know what it's like when you exert yourself all day. You do need some kind of sustenance, don't you? And if you want to continue fighting, you have to be sustained. Well, Saul said, no. I don't want you to eat anything at all. In fact, he makes an oath about that. Now, this word adjure means to put under an oath or a curse or to adjure. Cursed be the man, we read in verse 24, that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged on mine enemies. So none of the people tasted any food. It was a despotic oath with a focus on Saul himself. You know, read the words, that I may be avenged of mine enemies. Well, what about Yahweh's enemies? What about Israel's enemies? Wasn't Jonathan fighting those battles? Wasn't he dealing with the real problem? This wasn't about Saul. Leadership, brethren, is not about us, is it? If you're a leader of the ecclesia, it's not about you. It's about the flock. It's about the ecclesia. You're nothing. You've been put in a position of responsibility, yes, but you're really nothing. You've got to give yourself absolutely for the flock. He didn't understand that principle. He was king, and he thought that this was all about him. He had a problem, and it was, of course, to lead to terrible results. Verse 26, the people feared the oath. But you see, they'd found food. Look at verse 25. And all they of the land came to a wood, and there was honey upon the ground. So there was this wild beehive. And no one had ever harvested the honey, so it was dripping out of the wax, the bees' wax. This was a wonderful source of nourishment. You know, anybody, you know this in North Battleford, of course, if you eat honey, it's got a very immediate effect on you. You know, it's good for you. This is the very best thing that could have happened to the army, to eat this honey. But they couldn't because of the oath. It says in verse 26, when the people were come to the wood, behold, the honey dropped. But no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan, he was too busy fighting Yahweh's battles to have heard the self-centered oath of adjuration of his father. He didn't hear this, and nobody told him. So he comes along to the honey. He needs sustenance. So what does he do? He puts out his staff, takes a bit, and eats it. Look at verse 27. Jonathan heard not when his father charged the people with the oath, wherefore he put forth the end of the rod that was in his hand and dipped it in a honeycomb, put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes were enlightened. So he immediately responded to the taking of this food. He could have gone on fighting all night, could Jonathan, but not the men of Israel, because they'd been denied. So what's going to happen here? Well, Jonathan's going to be exposed to immediate mortal danger. In verse 28 we read, then answered one of the people, a little bit belated, isn't it, and said, thy father straitly charged the people with an oath, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food this day. And the people were faint because of it. And in verse 29, Jonathan said, my father hath troubled the land. See, I pray you, how mine eyes have been enlightened because I have tasted a little of this honey. You know, Jonathan is a wonderful example to us, isn't he? He and his father were like chalk and cheese. We know that Jonathan loved David And the love between those two men was just unbelievable. Why? Because they both loved God. They both loved the truth. They both desired the prosperity of Israel in spiritual things. You know, if you want to have a really good friend in the truth, then find someone who's dedicated to the work of the truth and dedicated to the study of the word. You won't get a better friend. And Jonathan and David were like that. They were not the same age, by the way. And some of my best friendships, and I've got many in the brotherhood, some of my best friendships are people, brethren, that are 20 years older than me. That can happen because we have the same interests and the same purpose in life. Jonathan and Saul weren't like that. Father and son were chalk and cheese. And you see, he gives us a good example. He rarely ever criticises his father. He didn't agree with him on many occasions, but he rarely ever publicly criticises him. Here's one occasion where he just can't avoid some criticism of his father. It's impossible. And so he says, "My father hath troubled the land. What he has done is not for the good of the ecclesia of God." So he puts it out there publicly. He says in verse 30, "How much more if haply the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found? For had there not now been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines?" And that's what he was interested in. He was interested in destroying the Philistines so they were no longer a problem to the ecclesia. But Saul's silly oath meant that they would continue to be a problem to the ecclesia. That's why Jonathan's upset. It's got nothing to do with Jonathan. It's got everything to do with the ecclesia. Whereas Saul's oath's got everything to do with Saul and nothing to do with the ecclesia. And we can learn from that, brethren. Because sometimes you see people put themselves forward as though they're important in the scheme of things. We're not. What's important is the prosperity of Yahweh's heritage. That's why Saul was made king, captain of my people. My inheritance, my heritage. That's why I put him there. Not for himself, but for the ecclesia. And we've got to keep that in mind at all times. So let's have a look what happens in the sequel to this terrible oath that he makes. Verse 35. "Saul built an altar unto Yahweh, the same was the first altar that he had built." Well, it's about time, isn't it, Saul? Start building some spiritual things into your life. He's a bit late. Anyway, but he builds his first altar. Let me read in verse 36, "And Saul said, let us go down unto the Philistines by night." You remember his oath said, you're not going to eat anything until the evening. So the people are starving. And they're weak. And they're frail. The soldiers can no longer fight. But look what he says in verse 36. "Let us go after the Philistines by night and spoil them unto the morning light. And let us not leave a man of them." Look at the response of the people. You know, there's an exasperation in these words, isn't there? You can just see those people. Those fighting men of Israel said, "Oh, well, whatever you think's the right thing." Got it? They're exasperated. They can't believe their ears. Who is this idiot who's made an oath that they can't eat anything and then says, "You've been fighting all day, brethren. Now let's fight all through the night. Come on. Where's his brains?" They're exasperated with their king. And we read on that Saul sees the exasperation, and so does the priest, because the priest says at the end of verse 36, "Then said the priest, let us draw near hither to God." That's not a bad idea, is it? "And Saul asked counsel of God, shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them into the hand of Israel? But he answered him not that day." And Saul knew there was something wrong. He knew there was something wrong. And in verse 38, Saul said, "We've got to sort this out. Draw near hither all the chief of the people and know and see wherein this sin hath been this day. For as Yahweh liveth, which saveth Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." That's another oath. So he's got two of them now. If it's in Jonathan my son, the problem, he says, he will surely die. And he involves the name of God. "But there was not a man among all the people that answered him." The people stood there stunned at the stupidity that they were observing in their king. couldn't believe it. And no one was going to say, well, look, you know, we could solve this problem right now. Jonathan ate the honey. They weren't going to do that. Verse 40. Then said he unto all Israel, be ye on one side, and I and Jonathan will be on the other. And the people said, oh, well, do whatever you want to do. And so they took a lot. Verse 41. Verse 42, Saul said, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son, because the people, that is the army, was put on one side. Saul and Jonathan were chosen in the lot. Now take the lot, he says, between me and my son. And Jonathan was taken. And look at verse 43. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what thou hast done. And Jonathan told him and said, I did but taste a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand, and lo, I must die. I think there might have been other words swimming around in his brain which didn't come out of his mouth. But he didn't think very much of his father's oath. You can get that sense out of what he's saying. And Saul answered, God do so and more also. Look how he involves God in this. For thou shalt surely die, Jonathan. So he's reinforcing his second oath that Jonathan's going to die. But it doesn't happen, does it? Look at verse 45. And the people said unto Saul, shall Jonathan die who hath wrought this great salvation in Israel? God forbid. As Yahweh liveth, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he hath wrought with God this day, unlike you, Saul. So the people rescued Jonathan that he died not. So Saul went up from following the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place, not completely destroyed. In other words, they would continue to be a danger to the ecclesia because of the folly of Israel's first king. If he had been anything like Jonathan, they would have wiped out the Philistines out of the land of Israel that day. And that would have given great relief to the brotherhood. But it didn't happen because of these events. And these events set a process in motion. Saul's foolish oath is left unfulfilled. And it probably started the rot. You know what it's like? You know, think about your own life, brethren and sisters and young people. You know that you shouldn't do certain things, don't you? You know you shouldn't get into certain places, don't you? But what happens if, under a period of weakness, you end up in those places? It's a whole lot easier next time, isn't it, to go down that road? You know that's true, and I know it's true. It's the first time it's the biggest problem. And here is the first oath that Saul breaks. And from now on, he's going to break every single one that he makes. Every single one, except the one he didn't have time to break the day before he died. So if you let it start, you're in trouble. You can recover yourself. You can go back and start again. You can seek forgiveness for any failure. But if you go down his path, you're doomed. That's the lesson of this. So let's learn these lessons. Let's have a quick look at some more of Saul's oaths. 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verse 25. Now, all of you, of course, know that this is the chapter in which David comes up to the Valley of Elah, and after some discussion with Saul, he goes out and he kills Goliath. Absolutely magnificent act of faith by an 18-year-old. He was somewhere in that age, 18 or 19 years of age. And when David arrives in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 25, he can't believe his ears, because it's pointed out to him that this huge 9'6", I mean, high as that ceiling, a 9'6" Philistine is challenging Israel and defying the God of Israel. And they tell him about this, and he sees the men running away from Goliath. And in verse 25, the men of Israel said, have ye seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel as he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches. That didn't interest David. And will give him his daughter. That didn't interest David. And make his father's house free in Israel. Well, that might have been attractive, because they came from a pretty poor house. And David spoke to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth the Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? He can't believe his ears that the king has to offer his daughter, Merab, to the man who kills this giant. That's ludicrous, he says. Where's your faith? Do you have to offer some sort of prize in a lottery, to get someone to do something for the truth? Come on. He can't believe it. Because he asked them to repeat it. He says, could you repeat that again? Did I hear what you said? That's David for you, see? That's his kind of spiritual approach to things. He can't believe that the eldest daughter of Merab has been offered. You know, when we come to the end of this chapter, we know the culmination of this story. Verse 55, and when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he knew full well that David would kill the giant. He knew that. So he says to Abner in verse 55, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell. Now, this is a conundrum, isn't it? I used that word over here once, and someone said, what's that word mean? Well, a conundrum means it's something that's opposite. It doesn't fit. Come back to chapter 16. 1 Samuel 16, verse 19. For when Saul got into his moody periods, he needed someone to play a musical instrument. Verse 19, wherefore Saul sent messages to Jesse, because he'd heard about this young boy, David, who was a marvellous player of musical instruments. Send me David, thy son, which is with the sheep. And so he sent, and in verse 21, David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly. He became his armour bearer, and Saul sent to Jesse, saying, let him stay with me, because he's found favour in my sight. And that's what David did for some while, before he went back to the sheep. So you see, Saul did know David. He'd had him there in his palace. He was there as his armour bearer for a while. So how come? How come he asks at the end of chapter 17, who is this boy? Well, you see, what he's asking, brethren, sisters and young people, is not who is David. He knew David. He's asking, what house does he come from? What family does he come from? Because you see, I've made a promise that whoever kills Goliath is going to have my eldest daughter Merab to wife. And I'm a king. And she's a princess. I don't want to marry her to some poor household. I don't know this Jesse. Who is he? So he's saying to Abner, find out. So Abner goes out to the army, because we know there were men from Bethlehem there, don't we? David's brothers were there. So he goes out and he finds some men. He says, you know anything about the house of Jesse? You know what he got back? You know the story he got back? The story he got back was that that's a poor house. And there was a shadow, a cloud over that family. You ever thought why David didn't turn up to the feast that Samuel put on for Jesse and his sons? When Samuel said to Jesse the day before, I want all your family there, all your sons. You ever wondered why David was not invited? Well, I believe, and there is evidence in the Word of God for this, I believe that David was an embarrassment to Jesse. That Jesse probably had played around. And David may well have been born outside of Jesse's marriage, if you know what I mean. David is one of the finest types of the Lord Jesus Christ in the Word of God, and nearly every one of them had a question mark over their origins. And they said to our Lord, we be not born of fornication like you. We heard about your mother. Now, I can give you a few clues on that. That's all I'm going to say on that. But there was a dark shadow over the family of Jesse. And the men of Bethlehem would have said, oh no, I wouldn't be marrying my daughter into that house. So that's why you read in chapter 18 of 1 Samuel these words in verse 2. And Saul took him that day and would let him go no more home to his father's house. So when David comes back, he's got the head of the giant in his hand. Saul says, don't worry about that. Deal with that later. Of course, he takes it off to Jerusalem. We know. He says, you're not going home. Why not? You're not going home. Okay. Because Saul does not want him to go back to that house and to be identified with Jesse. He doesn't want anybody to know that David's the son of Jesse, because he's got to give Merab, his daughter, to David. But it doesn't happen, because, you see, David gives Saul an excuse. Come to verse 17 of chapter 18. And Saul said to David, behold my elder daughter Merab. Her will I give thee to wife. Yes, to keep my promise. Only be thou valiant for me and fight Yahweh's battles. By which he meant, if David goes out once too often, he's going to get clobbered one day by the Philistines. And that'll solve my problem, won't it? I won't have to give my daughter Merab. He already should have given her, but he hasn't. He's delaying. He's dilly-dallying. He's waiting for David to be killed in battle. That's what the rest of the verse says, isn't it? Look at verse 18. And David said to Saul, who am I? Now think about this. Here is the man who has already been anointed as Israel's next king. He spent time in the palace. He knows what it's like to be a king. And he says he's the champion of the nation. He's the man who's killed Goliath. He's the man who saved Israel. And he says, who am I that I should be the son-in-law of a king? You got humility like that, you're worthy of leadership. See, you don't think anything of yourself, then God can use you. But if you think you've got bigger boots than everybody else, and you end up like Saul. That's the lesson that comes out of that. But you see, Saul, he pounces on that. David's given him an excuse. He says, who am I that I should be the son-in-law to the king? And Saul says, oh, good-o. So what does he do? Verse 19, it came to pass at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given unto Adriel the Meholathite to wife. So Merab is married to someone else. And that is going to lead to a disaster for that family of untold proportions. Merab means increase. She marries the man Adriel, flock of God. And the scene is set for an agonizing disaster some decades later. We'll come to that shortly. Now, another oath of Saul. Just go on a page, what's in the next page? 1 Samuel chapter 19. And in verse 1, Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants, that they should kill David. So he makes it quite plain he wants David murdered. And so Jonathan intervenes in the following verses, and he gets his father to relent. Look at verse 6. And Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore. And God's name comes into it again. As Yahweh liveth, he shall not be slain. So Jonathan intervenes. He gets this oath from Saul. But verse 10 tells us that it wasn't very long. We don't know exactly how long. But David's in the palace. He's playing his instruments before Saul. And verse 10 says, and Saul sought to smite David even to the wall with the javelin, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence. So he broke that oath probably within days. Another one swept aside. Another one bites the dust, as they say. You know, he knocked over oaths and vows like you're knocking over 10-pin bowls. Didn't care about him at all. What a man he was. So what's motivating this man? Well, flesh. Indignation. We've just read that in 1 Samuel 18, verse 2. I'm not going to have my family associated with that grubby family down there in Bethlehem, or not on your life. Jealousy. 1 Samuel 18, verse 8. The women sang, Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. And he was grievously jealous over that. Fear. Chapter 18, verse 15. 14 will do. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and Yahweh was with him. It was obvious to everybody, including Saul. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. He could see that this man had all the qualities of leadership, but he had none. So he feared the consequence, and pride, of course. 1 Samuel 20, he says to Jonathan, don't you realise that if David remains alive that you won't be king? Jonathan would have said back to him, I want David to be king. See, so pride was motivating him. It was all about Saul and his house. Well, let's come along to 1 Samuel 28, verse 10. He keeps this one. 1 Samuel 28, verse 10. He He's in the house of the witch of Endor. You know, it's the end door, the last door. And it's the last door he's going to go through. Because when he leaves this door of the house of the witch of Endor, he's going to die the next day on Mount Gilboa. So the game is up. And of course, in his zeal, he had tried to eradicate witches. We read this, of course, in the record. Verse 9, and the woman said unto him, suspecting it may be Saul, behold, thou knowest what Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that are familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Wherefore then layest thou a snare for my life to cause me to die? And Saul, in his utter desperation, because God would not answer him, verse 10, he swore to her by Yahweh, saying, as Yahweh liveth, there shall no punishment happen to thee for this thing. Now, he kept that oath because he was dead the next day. You know, the normal Saul, if he'd lived on for another couple of weeks, he would have said, well, that was a stupid thing to say. Go out and knock a head off. But he was dead. And the only oath that he kept in his whole life was that one to a woman that did not even believe in Yahweh by whom he had sworn. Isn't that incredible? It shows you the degradation into which this man had stooped. He tried to eradicate witches and now he's going there to get advice. Samuel's prescient words of 1 Samuel 15:23 come back to haunt this man. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. And that's where he ended up. So what about David in contrast to Saul? When you look at David, David is a covenant keeper, isn't he? Every single vow that he made, he kept. So let's just sweep through some of the covenants that David made in his life. 1 Samuel 18 verse 3, we don't need to look these up, I think you know them as well as I do. Jonathan and David made a covenant of mutual loyalty. That was kept throughout both of their lives. In 1 Samuel 20 verses 16 and 17, that covenant was renewed between them with an emphasis on preserving Jonathan's house. And David made sure that was fulfilled. In the chapter we read in 2 Samuel 21, when there had to be some sons of Saul put up on stakes, he said, you're not taking any of the family of Jonathan, because I made an oath about that. In 1 Samuel 24, verses 21 and 22, David's oath was made to preserve Saul's name and house. He had to relent, and Yahweh approved it. Seven sons of Saul had to be hung up in order for the land to have an atonement. 1 Samuel chapter 30, verse 15, you remember when David was sent back by the Philistines who were going up to fight against Saul, and of course Saul died in that battle. He came back with his 600 men, and Ziklag had been sacked by the Amalekites. Remember that event? And then they pursued after them, and they found an Egyptian in the field. He was just about dead. So they gave him a drink, and they revived him, and they propped him up. And David said, can you lead me to these Amalekites? And he says, yes, but you have to swear to me that you won't put me to death, because that's what most people would do. You know, I'll tell them, and I can lead you there, I can take you there, but when you're done and you're finished with them, you'll pop me off. Okay? So swear to me that you won't do that. And David says, I swear, kept it. In 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 35, David's oath that he had not been involved in Abner's assassination was true, wasn't it? That was kept. In 2 Samuel 19, verse 23, David's oath to Shimei that he would not die for his sin was kept. So why did Shimei die? Well, not because of David, not because of what he did to David. You know, he was the man that when David was fleeing from Absalom and he was climbing up the Mount of Olives, Shimei, the Benjamite, by the way, from the tribe of Saul, who probably thought that a king from Benjamin should be on the throne, he was throwing rocks and dust and he was abusing David. Get out of here! Glad to see the back of you! And he did this right down to the Jordan. It would have taken about 4 or 5 hours. And when Absalom was defeated and David comes back across the Jordan, guess who's the first man on the bank? A very humble Shimei. Welcome back, my king. And Abishai says, let me take his head off. He said that before too, hadn't he? And that man should have had his head off. David said no. And he swore that Shimei would not die for his sin. But on his deathbed he said to Solomon, you're a wise man. It's all in your hands. And Solomon called Shimei and said, you know, you should have died for what you did to my father. Shimei says, yeah, I should have. You're going to stay in Jerusalem, and if you leave this city, you're a dead man. Yep, thank you very much. I won't leave the city. Wasn't long after, his servants ran away. He leaves the city of Jerusalem. He brings them back. He's having a cup of tea. The servants are bringing his cup of tea in. Solomon's emissary turns up and says, Mr. Shimei, you've broken an oath, haven't you? And they cut his head off. Shimei did not die because of David's oath being broken. He died because of his own oath being broken. So that's how important it is to keep your oaths. Thou shalt perform unto Yahweh thine oaths. So let's come now to that chapter that we read, and we'll finish this off with what really is a very tragic scene. 2 Samuel 21. I want you to notice the context. You know, this is the wonder of the Word of God. What's the context of 2 Samuel 21? Well, let's just step back a page in our Bibles to 2 Samuel 20 and verse 1. Now, this is when David came back from the problems over Absalom and company. And, of course, there was a dispute between the people. At the end of chapter 19, the men of Judah, of course, had welcomed back their king, and the men of Israel were up in arms, and they said, verse 43 of chapter 19, we have 10 parts in the king, and we have also more right in David than you do, Judah. Why didn't you ask us to be involved in bringing back the king? Now, this wouldn't happen in ecclesial life. We would never have these sort of disputes, would we, about silly little things like that. Well, they didn't think it was silly. So a man rose up in verse 1 of chapter 20. There happened to be a man of Belial, a worthless man, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri. Sheba? Anyone know what Sheba means? Seven. Remember the well, Beer, Sheba? The well of seven. What's the covenant number? Seven. And what does he say? We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. In other words, he's saying, we have no king. We got no king. Got it? That's your context. We're going to come to that in our exhortation, because that's what our exhortation will be about. Israel's declaration, we have no king. We're going to see how that's tied intimately with Gibeah of Saul. So come back to chapter 21. What's happening here? There was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year. So God was judging the people of Israel. And David recognised that. As Rotherham puts it, he sought the face of Yahweh. And Yahweh said, it respecteth Saul and his house as to bloodshed, in that he put to death the Gibeonites. So Saul, in his zeal for Israel, had put to death the Gibeonites. And, of course, an oath had been broken in so doing. 500 years before, the princes of Israel swore an oath to the Gibeonites. Well, that's a long time ago. 500 years. But that oath still stood. So what is going to happen here? Well, in verses 1 to 11, we have this record of 3 years of famine for Saul breaking Israel's oath to the Gibeonites and the outcome. Let's just work down. David inquires of Yahweh. He seeks his face. He wants to know why the wheels have fallen off. Gibeonites. Gibeonites, brethren and sisters, come from the city, the town of Gibeon. It means a hill city. So it's very closely related to Gibeah. In fact, if you go to Strong's dictionary, Strong's number for Gibeonites is 1391, and the number for Gibeah is 1390, so they're next door to each other, because they both mean hill or hillock. Got the link? Verse 2, we read this. And the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn unto them. And Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. This word sworn happens to be Shava. It's the root of Sheba. And Shava means to seven oneself. Now that doesn't make any sense to us, does it? No, if we were doing this, we wouldn't think that you had to say it seven times. But that's what they used to do. Well, they had seven things. You know when Abraham made his covenant with Abimelech? That wasn't a covenant about setting up an ice cream parlour in the wilderness, I can tell you that. That was about the truth. Abimelech wanted to become a Christadelphian. So what did Abraham do? He brought out seven ewe lambs. And they named the place Beer Sheba, the well of the seven ewe lambs, because that's what confirmed the covenant. So you sevened yourself. You know that in the seventh promise of Genesis 22 that God makes to Abraham, that that whole chapter is sprinkled with sevens? It's a seventh promise. Abraham does seven things to go from Beersheba, the well of the seven, to get to Moriah. When he gets to Moriah, he does seven things to prepare to go up the mountain with Isaac. When he gets to the top of the hill, he does seven things. When he offers the ram, he does seven things. You can count them up. They're there. And then what does God do in verse 16? I've sworn by myself that in blessing I will bless. You know what the word sworn is? This word. Shabbat. To seven oneself. A seven is the covenant number. So that's why it plays its part here. So what happens here? Verse 3. Wherefore David said unto the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you, and wherewith shall I make the atonement, that ye may bless the inheritance of Yahweh? Atonement? Yes. Means to cover. This is the word kafar, the normal word for atonement in the Old Testament. To cover, to purge, to make an atonement. And an atonement needed to be made for that nation because there had been an oath broken. And so it's going to cost something, some lives, sadly. You know, David could have made a number of excuses, couldn't he, brethren? We hear a lot of excuses today about why you can't do this and why we should let that happen. Don't we? We hear a lot of excuses. And sometimes those excuses are made when there's covenants involved. David doesn't make any excuses. He could have said, well, Saul was showing zeal towards the ecclesia, towards Israel and Judah. Isn't that a good thing, to show zeal towards the ecclesia? Yes, but not if you're breaking a covenant in doing it. So that excuse wouldn't work for David, would it? Or he could have said, what about the statute of limitations? Surely a 500-year-old oath is extinct. You know, I hear with my own ears, I hear words like this. Oh, why don't you come up in the 21st century? Come on. This is the 21st century. You're living in the last century, maybe the one beyond that. When there's covenants involved, brethren and sisters and young people, it doesn't matter when they were made. This was 500 years ago. And God says, I'm holding you to it. And he brings a famine on the land year after year for 3 years until they get their act together. So David doesn't use that excuse. He knows that's not going to work. And he could have used this excuse. Well, why should Israel be suffering for Saul's past actions? That's not my problem. It's not our problem. He's dead. Doesn't matter. Your brotherhood made a covenant, God will hold you to it. Anyway, he could have said to Gibeonites, they're only Gentiles. Come on. They're just Gentiles. Who cares about them? Well, David did care about them, and so did God. And they had a covenant with Israel. And that can't be ignored. So David made no excuses. He did what he had to do. Come down to verse 5. Well, verse 4. And the Gibeonites said unto him, we will have no silver or gold of Saul, nor of his house, neither for us shalt thou kill any man in Israel. He said, well, what am I going to do? What do you want? And they answered the king, the man that consumed us and that devised against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the coasts of Israel, let 7 men of his sons be delivered unto us. Why 7, do you think? Well, it's the covenant number. And the covenant had been broken. And we will hang them up unto Yahweh. Now, where do you reckon they're going to hang them up? Look what it says in the word. In Gibeah of Saul, where covenants were first made and broken by the nation. That's where you're going to hang them up. The place where God got the first king of Israel from, his hometown, which represents covenants broken. We'll hang them up in Gibeah of Saul. And king said, I'll give them. But the king spared Mephibosheth. You know, this covenant that Joshua had made, brothers and sisters and young people, said this. And Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them and let them live, and the princes of the congregation swear unto them. Shabbat. They severed themselves unto them. Neither the passage of time or change of circumstances cancel out an oath involving the name of Yahweh. Saul had broken the covenant, hence 7 of his sons would be taken to make atonement for that covenant. But David would keep his covenant to Jonathan. So the following verse, verse 8, tells us that he doesn't take the sons of Jonathan. Or at least verse 7 tells us that, but he takes in verse 8 the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth. Now this is a different Mephibosheth to the son of Jonathan that's referred to in verse 7. So this is a family name, obviously. So there are 2 Mephibosheths here, quite different. And the 5 sons of Michael, it says. The 5 sons of Michael. Now this should read Merab. The margin of my Bible says Michael's sister. So it's not Michael, it's Merab. She was the oldest daughter of Saul who had been given to a man called Adriel. And they had had 5 sons. Now we don't know what age they were. Probably, you know, 20s, maybe, thereabouts. Maybe into the teenage years. But there were 5 sons of Merab. And so they send down to the house of Adriel, the Maholathite, and say, those your 5 boys? Yep, they're my 5 boys. I'm very proud of them. Right, I'm taking them. And they rip them out of the hands of the father and the mother and trot them off to Gibeah of Saul. Because Mahola wasn't anywhere near Gibeah. They had to trot across the hills. So the 5 sons of Merab are ripped from their grasp. You know, when we read that, don't we? What if someone walked into this hall and said, it's a family here with 5 boys? I want them. I'm going to shoot them against the wall. How'd you feel about that? Not too good, eh? Well, it happened to this family. And why did it happen to this family? Because Saul broke covenants. That's why. So the family is suffering the consequences of the foolishness of the father. That sometimes happens. And here is Rizpah. What a woman. Look at verse 10. She's had 2 of her sons taken as well. She's born these to Saul. But I want you to notice something the record tells us here. Verse 10. And Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock. From the beginning of harvest until water dropped upon them out of heaven, and suffered neither the birds of the air to rest on them by day, nor the beasts of the field by night. So here are your seven boys. Five sons of Merab, two sons of Rizpah. They're hung up on trees, out in the open. And of course, you know what happens. You put them out in the open, well, the birds come along. They want to peck the flesh off these bodies. And at night, the wild dogs come up and they want to reach up and rip flesh off these bodies. So Rizpah is awake day and night. She gets snatches of sleep. You know, she spends 6 months doing this. 6 months. It says from the beginning of harvest, that's barley harvest, that's Abib, until water dropped upon them out of heaven. That's the beginning of the rainy season. You know, the early rains. 6 months she does this. Chewing away the birds of prey and the wild animals that want to consume what's left of these bodies and gnaw on their bones. She's acting, you know, she's acting like someone who's got a covenant, isn't she? But look at verse 11. And it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, the concubine of Saul, had done. She was a concubine. No covenant had been made by Saul to her. And I think I remember another concubine. The one who began this story, remember? When she ran away from the Levite, who had made no covenant with her either. And she committed whoredom, she went to her father, he went to collect her, they got to Gibeah, she ends up dead and cut up into 12 pieces. Remember that? That's where the story ends. And here is a concubine who had no covenant with Saul. But she operates as though she did have one. And David recognised that. So he rewards her. Verse 12. And David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh Gilead. Isn't that interesting? The place where Jacob made a covenant with Laban. The place where Saul sent his army to deliver men who thought they might make a covenant with Nahash the Ammonite. And they got the bones of these grateful men of Jabesh Gilead, the bones of Saul from the grateful men who had buried them, and they brought them back. See in verse 13, and he brought up from thence the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son, and they gathered the bones of them that were hanged. So they got the bones of these seven boys and the bones of Saul and Jonathan. Verse 14. And the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, buried they in the country of Benjamin in Zelah, in the sepulchre of the bent man. It all began by being bent. And that's how it ended up. And the record says they buried them in the sepulchre of Kish. Where was the sepulchre of Kish? Do you reckon? Well, it says Zelah here. Yeah, it's a little siding. You know where the sepulchre of Kish is? Gibeah of Saul. That's where it is. And God suffered himself, says Rotherham's translation, to be entreated for the land after this. While a woman called Rizpah wept her heart out. And another woman called Merab, the oldest daughter of Saul, wept her heart out for the rest of her life because her father could not keep covenant. And the nation generally rejoiced in their new king, the beloved, who kept covenant all of his life to lay the foundation for the man we're about to remember when we partake of bread and wine.